Wendy warned me that there might be video recording, so I went ahead and set up a primary light and a cross fill because there's nothing like a politician with a theater degree to really do a lot of image crafting. Then I realized, nope, still bald and doughy. Nothing's going to help. So given that, we'll just have to focus on the content since there's not much to look at here. Thanks. It's great to be talking with RPEA in South Central. Although I see a couple of Southeast stowaways, it's always good. my own background reflects that a little bit. I was born and raised in Anchorage. Lived there. Still got family in Anchorage. Went to school outside, and then I finally got it right and moved to the capital city. It took me a little while to mature. What can I tell you? My own background in public policy is one of all civilian service, but public service. I interned for Ted Stevens in Washington, D.C. I interned for Tony Knowles here in the Capitol building. Spent a little time at the Department of Education and Early Development, and then got a job as a legislative staffer, working for a senator named Kim Elton. And I was on his staff when the legislature in 2005 passed what was then Senate Bill 141, which closed the defined benefit, the pension tiers of Alaska's retirement systems for all public employees, and opened up, effective in the middle of 2006, these current defined contribution only, individual account retirement tiers. I suspect that most of the people here grasp the difference, but just in case anybody's new to the subject, a pension, a defined benefit, takes a very long time to earn. You only earn a little bit each year you work, and you can never strike it rich and beat the market and end up with a massive lump sum to leave to your kids and grandkids, but you can't outlive it either. And so it is, we call it a defined benefit because when you retire, you know exactly what your check's going to be every month. The current defined contribution system, people often think of a 401k type plan, and this is very similar to that. You have an account, it's got your name on it, you control to a great extent the investments, and if you're super amazing and awesome at the markets, maybe you can strike it rich, and if you're not, let's hope you have enough when you retire to live out the rest of your days. By the way, how long will those be? You've got to plan accordingly. And that's all on you. There are a number of difficulties with having only the defined contribution system available for a public employer. And I'll just go through a few of those right now, talk a little bit about my bill, Senate Bill 37, and what it does to remedy those problems. Of course, the fact that with an individual account, the defined contribution we have now, you can't pool the risk. You don't have professional investment managers directing the investments, and you don't know how long you're going to live or what your needs might be. So those things sound like a bummer, but they're in fact a real fiscal problem and an economic problem, in addition to being more than just a bummer, a real problem for retirees. We'll start with professional investment managers. They do better. They make more money on the money. Study after study after study has gone through this. Your best aggregation of those studies shows that on the whole, professional investment managers like we have at the Permanent Fund, like we have managing the PERS Trust and the TERS Trust, they make about 100 basis points, about one percentage point per year more return on the investments. Part of that's more discipline in their investing. Part of that is that they can get lower fees associated with the costs of investing because they have a huge pool of assets to bring to the table, and they can tell Goldman and BlackRock and all these companies, oh, you want to be involved with us? We're going to need you to lower that fee over there in ways that individual investors just can't. It's take it or leave it. When you look at compound interest, and the aggregation of investment earnings over long periods of time, 100 basis points a year is a huge amount of money. It's colossal. The difference between making 6% and 7% a year every year for decades is a huge amount of money at the end. And what we don't get out of the investments, we either have to make up with more money up front or lower quality of life, lower living standard on the back end, or people outlive their individual investment account. And then the state is the payer of last resort, right? We'll come back to that in a minute. The other thing, of course, I've bounced off it a couple times, is what we call longevity risk. Knowing whether you're going to live 5 years after you retire or, God willing, 45 years after you retire is a huge factor in how you take the money out. If you don't know that, if you have to live on less because you haven't got a strong sense of how long you're going to need the money, your ability to maintain your home and go out to eat and go see the barber and all those things is reduced. And that has economic ripple effects throughout our economy. One of the great strengths of a pension system is that they're a tremendous economic shock absorber. The economy, the price of oil skyrockets and there's lots of jobs and retirees have what they knew they were going to get. And the price of oil tanks and the big three make cuts on the North Slope and the economy's in turmoil and Anchorage and the Fairbanks and the Matsu and retirees still know how much they're going to get. And the diner on the corner and the barber still know they're going to have their customers and they don't have to close their doors. So it's a very much like Social Security. It's a shock absorber in the economy and it's a role our retirees can play if they have some sense of how much money they can get to live on. So we'll move on just a little bit to some of the things in Senate Bill 37 and how that works. What SB 37 does is it gives a newly hired public servant in Alaska, and that would be state employees, that would be school district employees, including teachers, that would be municipal employees, including their public safety folks in police and fire, the ability to choose. You have a limited window after you're first hired on to choose either this current defined contribution system or a pension tier that is very, very similar to the last tiers we had back in 2005, 2006. It's a limited time window and it's an irrevocable choice, right? There's no mulligan on this. You get some education materials, of course, and some calculations. But the simple fact is that to manage a pension system, you have to have some sense of who's in it. And who's likely to be in it. And so SB 37 gives you a limited window to make that decision. So if you are coming into public service in Alaska after a stint in the military and you have a pension from Uncle Sam, you may very well choose that defined contribution plan, build up a cash account that you can use however you want. If you are coming into public service in Alaska because you have a spouse or significant other who is deployed here or on a temporary stint with whatever company they work for, and you're going to work, bring your skills as a teacher, bring your skills as a police officer. You don't think probably you'll stick around a full 5 years to vest in pension or 10 years to vest in health. You may very well want that portable cash balance, that individual account. You can choose that. But if your plan is to work and live in Alaska, make your life here, build your home here, retire here, odds are you're going to prefer that defined benefit, that pension plan. And actuaries, both working for the state and working for organized labor, have all agreed that that's likely to be well over 80% of participants who choose that pension plan. They plan to stick around and make Alaska their home. That's important because it gives us some stability and some predictability in how we manage the investments in the trust funds and how we expect to pay that out. I think it's important to address some of the fear issues that are out there. And maybe I'll do that briefly. I know I usually make this a longer talk, but I do really want to get to questions and answers with you. So I apologize if I leave a few things out. There are a lot of fear elements, and fear was a tremendous driver in 2005 when SB 141 passed because there was an unfunded liability in our pension systems. A number of our assumptions had not borne out or had not been updated in a surprisingly long time. And the markets had a crash back in 01, 02 that was being fully realized on the books as the actuaries worked through their audited financial statements. And so the question often comes up, what about unfunded liability? Aren't we just going to dig a new hole? You know, the simple fact is that there is no perfect system of predictions. There's no perfect pension system. So when we talk about the individual accounts, if you outlive your individual account, and as a public employee in Alaska, you didn't earn Social Security in the vast, vast majority of public sector jobs in our state. The state is the payer of last resort, right? We're talking about adult public assistance and or senior care benefits. We're talking about adult Medicaid. We may be talking about heavily subsidized by the state, living in a Pioneer home if things get to that level. And we could go on and on down the list, waiver services and the like. There isn't a trust fund like we have for PERS, like we have for TERS, spinning out Wall Street investment dollars to cover those costs. Those are covered from the general fund today. What we bring in oil taxes or other taxes today for this year's costs. Whereas when you have a trust fund, even if it does for a limited period get into an underfunded situation that you can work yourself out of, that trust fund continues to spin off other people's money, right? Investment dollars. And so it's a much more fiscally efficient way to meet those obligations. The other thing is that when Senate Bill 141 passed, what is that, 15 years ago now, a number of safeguards were put in place, and I don't demolish any of those with Senate Bill 37. So we have a second actuary whose job is to check the work of the first, right? I don't know how many of you recall, but as we worked our way through the origins of the unfunded liability that arose back then, we found, among other things, math errors by the actuaries. They compounded interest wrong. I mean, I got a 16-year-old who compounds interest, and she doesn't have any trouble with it. And the state recovered hundreds of millions of dollars in a lawsuit over that. So we have a second actuary that checks the work of the first. We have regular experience studies based on Alaska, not national factor tables, but Alaska experience with PERS and TERS about things like healthcare costs, things like longevity, how long people are living on average. And we could go on down the list of what those factors are so that we don't go years and years and years and years with outdated mortality tables and outdated healthcare assumptions so that we're not adjusting either our investment mix or our contribution rates today the way we need to keep up with and avoid unfunded liability problems. And we could run on down that list. The ARM Board, I think, was a valuable, that's the Alaska Retirement Management Board, a valuable safety check. The ARM Board has a couple of disinterested members who are not in the PERS and TERS systems. I think that's a valuable check as well. And that list continues, but rather than bore you with all the elements, I'll just hit a couple of additional points. One of those is that if we went back to tier three benefits for PERS, that's tier two for the teachers, we'd save a lot of money today. The simple fact is, remember I talked about how much less efficient and predictable an individual account is? Well, the simple fact is that we are having to oversave. We're adding more dollars up front to pre-fund a retiree's benefits, hopefully benefits with this individual account system, than we would if everybody were in tier two as a teacher, tier three as other public employees. When you do the math and work it out across all the public sector employees in the state, ballpark, $50, $60 million a year, right up front. Those dollars could go into a legacy unfunded liability. Those dollars could go into other services for the state of Alaska. They could reduce the deficit, right? The legislature would have those general fund dollars. I shouldn't say just the legislature. The legislature and municipalities and school districts would have those dollars to work with. But the other thing is, there's a cost we haven't talked about, and that's turnover. You folks are in South Central, so most of you probably don't know how sales taxes work, but in the rest of the state, we all pay a sales tax, right? I know that those of you living in Anchorage know how property taxes work, because I think you have the highest property taxes in the state, except maybe the North Slope Borough. The simple fact is that the cost of turnover is something for your municipal employees, and to a certain extent for your school district employees, you pay through your tax bill every single year. Let me break that down real quick. A state trooper hired right out of school, off to the Public Safety Academy either in Sitka or your Anchorage Police Department Academy, and then equipped, field training, the cost to get them from recruit, or rather from recruitment, to in the car, driving the beat, on their own, doing the job. It's about $190,000. $195,000 for a trooper. Juneau Police Department's about $168,000. Other departments are in there. When we turn over a cop or a trooper who we could have kept on because they've got 5 years experience, the weather's warmer in Washington and they can go earn a pension, be closer to grandma and grandpa with the kids. When we turn over that cop or that trooper we could have kept, you pay again that $195,000, roughly, $1,000. The average turnover cost of a teacher in Alaska, north of $22,000. Same story. With a pension, there's an incentive to stay. Without, a lot of people do their little Alaska stint and go home. They don't put down roots here, right? So in Anchorage, you're probably paying less than that $22,000, $25,000, but get much outside of Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, that number is way, way higher. If you have a local contribution, as most districts do in this state, you're paying 40, 45% of that out of your tax bill, right? And we can run on and on and on through the list of people we have a hard time attracting and keeping in public service. Wastewater plant operators, attorneys at the Department of Law, biologists. I mean, the rate at which biologists fly to the federal government is astounding, and we have constitutional obligations to manage our resources. I could spend a long time on this list, find something that everybody loves. The simple fact is, you're paying those turnover costs, and you don't have to. So, with that, I think I will probably stop talking. I've been on it for 20 minutes now, and most of the eyes on Zoom look like they're open. I'm not sure about Senator Gray Jackson. I may have put her to sleep. But everybody else seems to be awake. Poor Elvie's heard me do this shtick before. With that, I do want to get to your questions, see if I can provide some answers, but I'm happy to chat. We've got another 20, 25 minutes here before I need to go, so it's an opportunity. Wendy, do I turn it back to you here, or how should we handle this?
Well, let me start with the first question, and hopefully that will get some other people thinking about things. But one question that came up is, we know that there's another bill pending that is offering the, I believe it's the police and the fire emergency workers, the opportunity of doing a defined benefit plan. How would that bill affect the finances of the pension fund? I mean, your bill proposes for everybody to have that opportunity, but how would those limited bills that are pending affect the pension fund and our unfunded liability?
So those bills would create, as SB 37 would, those bills would create new tiers, right? Under our Constitution, thank heavens and the founders of our state, we have a no diminishments clause, which is why we make changes in tiers that apply only to the next group coming. Those bills have the right spirit. They're offered with the right heart and the right intention. And some of the folks in the police and fire professions sort of have this simile they use. It's like they're going to break down the door and rush into that emergency situation and prove that a pension system works for Alaska and everybody else can come in behind them later. My concern is that, not to put too fine a point on it, people will say, well, we took care of the heroes, the rest are a bunch of bureaucrats. And so I really feel pretty strongly that we need to address all our public servants together And it's always been the case that some folks make a better headline than others. The need remains the same, regardless. So in terms of the direct effect on the pension trusts, and you know, those of you who, there may be a tier one on here. I don't know if anybody here is old enough for that, but those, there might be a tier one retiree here, a couple of tier twos. I'm a tier three myself in PERS. It's really not going to have much effect. We will miss the opportunity, I think, to open up that pension trust fund and add additional contributions into that in ways where it has the opportunity in up years to help us grow our way out of the unfunded liability a little bit. Again, this is not Social Security, right? We are not funding this year's benefits with this year's contributions. We really do try to pre-fund so that what we put in, along with all of its earnings, which depending on your estimate, that's 55 to 60% of a benefit later on, fund the retirement system. Down years stink, up years where we make more than we expect are a great benefit. So it'll have very limited effect on the pension trust funds. I think we'll be missing an opportunity to help earn our way out of this problem a little bit. But the simple fact is that over time, we're investing and working our way out of the unfunded liability problem, and we'll continue to do so.
So, Senator, my name's Stephanie, and I'm monitoring the chat, and I just have a couple of things that I wanted to ask. The first one is, and this is sort of part of the history here that I think we'd all like to know about. If it costs less for defined benefits than defined contributions, why was the program closed? And what is the actual opposition to restarting it now? What are the arguments against?
Sure. So the program was closed based primarily on ideology and the belief that we shouldn't do these government programs that pool risk and pool investments and pay everybody the same. Individualized accounts are always better. And the belief, and I'm, you know, sort of in the sympathy for the other guys category, the belief that unfunded liabilities are a horrible thing, that steal from Alaskans' public services, or someday we'll have a broad-based tax again, steal from Alaska taxpayers to pay benefits of people who have already retired, who are working now, that should not be a priority for the state. I have a couple of disagreements with this philosophy. Just to put us in historical context, I don't know if you remember, there was the President Bush, George W. Bush, was floating trial balloons to try and privatize Social Security as well at the time, right? Based on the same philosophy, based on the same notion that some point in the future, Social Security may be in trouble because of our demographics. And we really ought to just do individual accounts. You invest it, it's on you, personal responsibility, personal opportunity. In that process, we saw some really unfortunate things in lawmaking and in the legislature. We saw, quite frankly, the Murkowski administration's director of retirement benefits and commissioner of administration twist a lot of numbers and frankly rely on a real dearth of understanding of how pension systems work, how they're put together, to strongly imply things that it's hard to say they're true. And you know, it's difficult for me. I don't want to cast aspersions, but I'll give you an example. The state, the administration would come in and say, the cost of these benefits is 24% of payroll. Well, if you look at both the current pre-funding rate and the unfunded liability rate of the tier one employees, and you average that in with what then were relatively few tier two and three employees. And again, you didn't differentiate between what it cost to pre-fund and what the unfunded liability rate contribution was. Sure, but when the conversation, when the context was 100% about what the going forward cost is, that's deceptive, right? And the administration would come in and say, every defined benefit employee you hire today comes with an instantaneous unfunded liability. Well, that's only true if the commissioner of administration was in breach of their fiduciary duty to set the rates. such that they pre-fund the system at the time. They didn't believe they were. They didn't believe that statement, but they made it anyway. And that's how this debate was conducted. And then you add in the sausage part of pure political muscle of folks who really believed in the philosophy. And they said, this unfunded liability is huge. It's going to get bigger. It'll never go away. The only possible solution is individual accounts. And so we ended up where we are now. The resistance, I think, to fixing this system and reopening pension opportunities to public servants, I think part of that comes from the philosophy. Part of that comes from a shortage of understanding. So my colleagues and I work on a constant basis to educate people who are here for other reasons. I mean, if you count up the number of people who knock on doors in the fall of even numbered years and say, I'm here to talk about the state pension system, you will have this many fingers. No, you'll have this many fingers up because I talk about it. But that's not why the people run, right? They run for public safety and they run for education, they run for environment and all these other issues. But the simple fact that you know at RPEA, that a lot of folks don't know is, if you don't have the public employees to make your passion program happen, it's not going to happen. And you can pass whatever bill you want. You can pass a bill that says the sun shall rise in the South. You don't have the manpower. So to make everything else work, we need people to do the work. We need to train them and keep them. That's part of what this pension system's about. And that education process is challenging when folks are here to fix what they perceive as the current budget by cutting it. It's nice to offer them a $55 million savings, but when somebody else says, wait a minute, it's gonna cost you $1 billion in 10 years, that may not be true, but the fear factor leads people to recoil. That's the hill we're struggling up.
Well, and our the director of our legislative committee actually makes a point, which is that SB 141 passed by a single vote in the House in 2005. And of course, that was so long ago now. Here we are today. So another question is, isn't the significant drop in state salaries or the lack of increases in salaries, does that not also play a role in turnover? If so, could pensions ever add up attracting employees despite the poor salary? Should the bill consider some significant salary increases to make it more attractive?
Of course it's a factor. Absolutely it's a factor. And I'd be selling snake oil if I said the only thing that ever made a difference to anybody was a pension. I mean, the simple fact is when I signed on with the state, I didn't know what a pension was and I was about to start earning one, right? I was interested in the work. But as time goes on and as people grow, or, you know, the average age of a new state employee is 46, not, I think I was 22, 23. As people grow and mature and go on to different places and priorities in their lives, they do start looking at their retirement security. And it becomes a major factor for a lot of people. I think I first learned about the pension system when somebody looked at me and said, oh, yeah, you watch, you're going to slip into those golden handcuffs and you'll never leave. Well, I mean, I don't know about golden. Like I said, I'm a tier three, not a tier one, but there is a lot of incentive to stay. Not because you're going to get rich. The average PERS retirement check comes out to just north of $36,000 a year, you know, fat city. The average PERS teacher benefit is, I think, oh, I'm gonna get this wrong and Cindy Spaniers is gonna shake her finger at me. No, she's too nice for that. But I think it's 25,000. It ain't a heck of a lot, but it's enough to keep the rent paid and the food on the table. do I believe that we are adequately paying the vast majority of our public servants in Alaska? No, I certainly don't. in some places and in some situations, especially when you look down the line at municipal employees, you're starting to see some of that reflected, right? There are signing bonuses for police officers. There are, when I was on the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly, I didn't mention that in my bio, but I did 7 years on the Juneau Assembly too. Something about the legislative sessions, the long hours, the incessant work, I decided to add municipal service at the same time. When I was at the City and Borough of Juneau, we couldn't keep paramedics. And so we put in place an incentive program where the city helped pay them for the, I can't remember if it was 12 months or 6 months that they could not do of their education here in Juneau. They had to go outside. And so if they'd sign a contract to come back and work for X number of years, we put $15,000, $20,000, I can't remember now, it's been too many years, into that education program. And if they left early, then they had to pay it back. Worked great, right? So there's all kinds of factors. And I'm not trying to suggest that my bill is the end all be all cure all. I do think it's a very significant piece.
Yeah. And just as a personal commentary on salaries, when I left the court system about 4 years ago, nearly all of the clerical workers who had bumped into longevity and were never going to get another pay raise, and who were tier ones, I might add, all had to get second jobs on their current salary, never mind what their pension was going to be. They all had second jobs at bookstores or, whatever they were. And I always wondered how that was going to work for them. Another question is, isn't there a difference in the employer contributions between the tiers? That is, the employer payment for each of the tiers. And how is that equitable to the defined contribution employees?
The legislature pooled and normalized it, or levelized it, I guess is the word. So all public employers are paying 22% of salary for PERS, whether you have a tier one employee in that job or a tier four employee in that job. All the school districts are paying 12.5%, it's 12.56% for their teaching employees. The question of equity, I think, is a fascinating one. I think two things happened. One is that the legislature and municipalities got together and said, look, bouncing this rate around as high as we're looking isn't going to work. Munis are going to start simply defaulting. There are a couple who are a decade in arrears. And by the way, if you think the IRS is bad about penalties and interest, guess what PERS does? Those municipalities will close their doors, right? They'll fold up and cease to be organized municipalities because there isn't the money in these tiny villages. And that's a terrible result, right? Because that increases state costs to provide the barest minimum of services out there. Not that we do a hell of a lot in tiny rural villages, but municipal governments, even the tiniest ones, are a real force multiplier for state government. And we're able to lean on them to provide things that the state doesn't want to pay for on a statewide basis, if we can help it. But I'm flying off on a tangent now. That level dollar amount prevents concerns that we had about whether employers were gonna have an incentive to shuffle off all their older employees and bring in new tier fours at every position they possibly could. It prevents unpredictability in public finances, and no legislator ever wants to be blamed for a local tax hike. So the state then makes what's called an on-behalf payment. Any difference between the 22% rate, or for TERS, the 12.5% rate, and the full actuarial rate that includes both your pre-funding and your unfunded liability payment, the state picks that up out of the general fund. So there's an interesting bill about that, by the way, that the governor's proposed. That's not disaster. I don't think he's being honest about some of the numbers, but it's not horrible. And we can talk about that another time. Are there potentially some equity issues? Maybe. It used to be that the state claimed to keep an individual ledger of each municipality's PERS liabilities and rate that they had to pay into the PERS trust fund. And one of the things we discovered was that it wasn't right, and it would take a krazillion dollars of forensic accountants to try and unwind it. But the way it was, brief story, I'll never forget. Murkowski's Commissioner of Administration was Annette Kreitzer, who had been Loren Leman's chief of staff in the legislature for years and years. And she came in to describe this to Senate Finance Committee. And my boss at the time sat on Senate Finance. This fact that they simply couldn't unwind these municipal accounts. They couldn't, if somebody sued and said, you're charging us the wrong rate, the state really couldn't defend itself in court. And as the presentation was sinking in and the members of the Senate Finance Committee were just agog at this, this has been going on for decades. How can it not be right? One legislator said, are you telling us there is no way to figure this out and get the numbers right? And Annette Kreitzer, I have political differences with her, but bless her heart, she swallowed and she said, through the chair, Senator, I'm telling you, I'm the newly appointed Commissioner of Administration and I'm here to help. So we erased the individual accounts. We went to a pooled system with a level contribution rate for everybody.
So is that the case that for people in defined contributions who are in different tiers, that the employer's paying the same amount? It sounded to me like in tier three, the employee, let me see what it is. The employer pays 8% to a tier three employee, but only 5% to a tier four employee. Is that how it's going? Or is it that it's 24% for, and I take it that the remainder that doesn't go individually is somehow or other part of making up for the unfunded liability?
Yeah, let's see if I can do these numbers from memory. Always a safe thing to do, right? So you have a tier three employee, and the cost to pre-fund their pension as a percent of payroll is about, they're putting in a certain amount of their paycheck. But the employer's cost to pre-fund their pension and health should they earn those is about 8% roughly, right? So then you have your four employee, and the employer puts in, I'm going to get these numbers wrong, just watch me try and do this. The employer is putting, I think it is 3% into a health reimbursement account and 2% into a just in case you die on the job account. And then it's 7%, Cindy, nod or shake your head, into the individual retirement account. Maybe it's 5. Anyway, it works out to be about, 5. Thank you. And the employee also puts some money out of their paycheck in. They put in 7 or 8% of their earnings. When you aggregate the employer's portion, it doesn't come 22%. The delta between that and 22 drops to the unfunded liability of the pension system. Likewise, for that tier three employee, the employer's not putting in 22%. The delta between what they put in and 22 drops to the unfunded liability in the DB system. But one of the key points that I keep hitting on, right, is the fact that the employer is putting in, you know, significantly more for the defined contribution employee than the defined benefit employee, the person earning a pension, means that if we let everybody into the defined benefit system, we could pay in the same number of dollars and be $50, $55 million ahead across all employers every year. I don't know about you, but I don't have $55 million of cuts to propose in state government elsewhere. And while I support broad-based taxes, I'm not looking to draw an extra $55 million more than we need to out of Alaskans' pockets, right? I'd like the more efficient option, please.
And can you tell us what the status of the bill is and how it proceeds and how individuals might involve themselves in advocacy? RPA is nonpartisan and nonpolitical, but for those who might be interested, we have had some training on legislative process and basis, so it might be helpful to know what those steps would look like.
Absolutely. So Senate Bill 37 is in the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee, and we're working to get it heard so that we can move it on through the process. This bill is a long-term project. It's not going to pass this year. So what would be helpful are a few things. First and foremost, and always, letters and emails that I can put in the packet that support the bill. You can send them to the chair of the committee with a CC to me. You can send them to me and I will provide them to the chair. However you want to do it, make sure they go to your legislator too. The person you elected, you and your neighbors elected to represent you, needs to hear that this is something that matters to human beings who live in their district and vote. We have hundreds of bills. We have the budget. We have all the big issues out there and everybody ran for a different reason. We don't know what matters to you unless you tell us. We listen best at the door in the fall in even numbered years, but we're listening pretty good now if the staff says, hey, this email's from a constituent. Here you go, boss, right? That one perks up our interest and we read every word. So that's the other thing in the long term is, when that candidate knocks on your door and says, hey, you're a super voter and can I count on your vote? You can say, tell me what you think about a pension. And a lot of them weren't expecting that question. That's good. That's why knocking on doors is important. But there's no better time to educate a politician than when they're running for office. Their ears are wide open at that point. So email or write about Senate Bill 37 now. Be sure that you let your legislators know it matters. The next time somebody comes around looking for votes or asking for cash, let them know what matters to you.
And remind us in a nice kernel, what is the advantage to reinstituting a defined benefits plan for those of us already retired in a defined benefits plan?
Those who are already retired in a pension plan, what it does is it makes state government more efficient, more affordable. It gets a better bang for the buck. And by reopening new contributions into the pension trust funds, it gives us an opportunity through increased investment earnings to help earn our way out of the defined or out of the that legacy unfunded liability. Small enough, Colonel?
That's very small and very kernel-y. Thank you.
I was thinking it was more like a sergeant, but I.
I see no other questions in the chat. So if others have things that they would like to add, feel free.
Yes, this has been a very informative talk and I appreciate Senator Keel being with us. And we do have him for a couple more minutes. So now is your opportunity to ask away questions about the Senate bill or related ones.
I bored everyone into a stupor. Mission accomplished.
Maybe you've answered everybody's question.
Please.
Could you explain the unfunded liability status a little more? I appreciate your idea of, with your bill, that we might whittle that down a little over time. But how, let's say your bill doesn't pass, where are we on the unfunded liability and where are we likely to be in 10 years with or without your bill?
Great. So the there's a simple answer and a really complicated answer. Let me start with a simple and I'll only give half of the super complex. The simple answer is we're paying it off over time. We're continuing to pay it and between payments and some good earnings years. We're making gradual progress. We'll get there. The more complex answer is that we've changed the way we calculate a number of things to address the unfunded liability over a longer period of time, which lowers our annual payments, but means we're paying more over the long term, right? That notion of an unfunded liability is how many dollars would you have to have in there right now to, along with contributions from people who are continuing to earn benefit credits and investment earnings, pay enough to cover the benefits people have already earned, including what we expect to happen with inflation and post-retirement pension adjustments and the cost of healthcare and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The thing about a system with 20, 25 different assumptions built into it, always gonna be wrong, right? Sometimes it's wrong to the good, sometimes it's wrong to the bad. You add them up each year when you get those audited, consolidated final financial statements from 2 years ago that all the accounting team and finance are finally done with. And you look at the damage and you go, okay, this year helped, this year hurt. So ballpark numbers right now, PERS is short about $4.75 to $4.75 billion. TERS is short about $2.25 to $2.25 billion. So seven. There was a time when we were looking at 12. And a couple of smart financial moves and great investment earnings, plus an extra deposit back when Parnell was governor and we had a lot of money coming in, those got us down into a much more manageable place. We probably won't try, looking forward 10 years, to get to 100% funded status. We'll probably, and now, put on the Carnac the Magnificent hat, right, and get the envelope up to hold in my forehead. We'll probably end up shooting for about a 90% funded status over the long term. Does that short us a little bit on investment earnings? Yeah, but the calls for current cash are gonna be such to provide public service, to educate kids and plow streets and keep the prison doors locked and have nurses at API and docs and whatever, that you won't see, the dedication to getting to 100% funded status, that's okay. That's within a rational realm of fiscal responsibility. I would like it to be at 100% funded. It's not likely to happen. So what we do every year, there's a new number that is to the good, is we average that over 5 years. Every year there's a new number that's to the bad. We amortize that over 25 years. It's a little bit of a cheat, right, in terms of making our payments, but it's going to get us to a funded status where investment earnings are doing well. We still are making our payments and we're able to both make our payments and provide the services. We are not headed for a point that I can see, and I'll stay vigilant about this, but it's right now I see it as low risk. We're not headed for a point where the systems are only half funded and oh my God, it's terrible and we need zillions of dollars every year and let's pass a constitutional amendment to stop robbing you to pay the fat cat bureaucrats who aren't working, right? That's the nightmare. I don't see that scenario. We spent a lot of time and effort pushing back an attempt to move to what they call pay as you go, which literally was continue to pay down the trust fund and get to the point where we pay benefits out of current cash every year. There's no greater risk of a constitutional amendment that would undo the diminishment clause and take away the protection for pensions than ending up in a pay-as-you-go system, right? Just a nightmare. It's also radically inefficient fiscally, because remember that bit about investment earnings paying 50, 60% of the benefit? Yeah, they're gone. They're zero now. That's dumb. But the guy who proposed that is retired now. So hopefully we'll just keep that good and buried.
If I can step in here for, no, that was good. If I can step in, Will, in December, we had Rob Johnson talk about the history of the pension fund. Rob Johnson is the chair of the ARM board. And we did record that. And it is on the RPEA website, the South Central chapter under December. And he talks all about the pension fund and its history and how we got to where we are. And so if you're interested, please go on the RPEA South Central chapter website under our meetings and agendas, and you can actually listen to his 45-minute talk just about the pension fund. So are there any other questions? Stephanie, do you have any that you see in the chat?
I have none. I think that the senator has covered just about everything. Thank you.
Okay.
You'd be surprised how much longer I can go if I try to cover everything. Put a cow in a coma.
Well, I very much appreciate you spending time with us today. We've got several thank yous, great presentation in the chat window. So we do definitely appreciate having you. And it's a nice format to have these special presentations over Zoom, and we're going to try to continue doing that. So if there's something you want to talk to us about, please reach out anytime and we'll get something scheduled.
Well, that's great. Thanks everyone for having me. I appreciate you engaging on this. And, you know, I also want to thank you for your public service. I mean, there are a lot of names on here I recognize. Most of them have dropped off because they were bored. But names that I have seen over my 20 some odd years in state service now, people who've made a difference for Alaska, right? And it's too easy to vilify people who are in public service. But the simple fact is you do the work. And you've done a tremendous amount to shape our state, and we owe you a debt of thanks, as well as keeping your pension checks coming on time.
Well, thank you so much, and I will stop the recording now and let you all get on with your day. Will, did you have a question? Great. You were raising your hand. Oh, just a goodbye. Okay. Bye, everybody.
All right. Bye-bye.
What's all over?